From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Indira Lakshmanan. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we'll touch down in Philadelphia, where Bay Staters took center stage, including keynote speaker Senator Elizabeth Warren.
On one side is a man who inherited a fortune from his father and kept it going by cheating people, by skipping out on debts. A man who has never sacrificed anything for anyone.
Also today, Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy on what Democrats need to do about gun violence.
42% of all guns sold in America are not subject to a background check. That's insanity.
And economist Robert Frank takes a hard look at luck and how our own luck affects our politics.
Conservatives think all their success is due to skill and effort, and liberals think that much of theirs is due to good fortune.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and we begin today in Philadelphia on day two of the Democratic National Convention. One of tonight's speakers at the DNC will be Erica Smigelski. She's the daughter of Sandy Hook Elementary School principal Dawn Hawkspring, a victim in the 2012 massacre in Newtown, Connecticut. Following that horrific rampage by a lone gunman who killed 20 children and six adults, Connecticut passed one of the strongest gun control laws in the nation. Earlier today, we spoke with Connecticut's Governor Daniel Malloy. He's co-chair of the Democratic Convention's Platform Committee, chairman of the Democratic Governors Association, and he spoke last night to the convention. We started by asking Governor Malloy about what he wants to hear the party say tonight about gun laws and the Second Amendment.
Well, I think what the party has said, says in its platform and has said every step of the way, is that we should take common sense steps to secure ourselves in this nation. For instance, we should not be selling guns to terrorists in America. 42% of all guns sold in America are not subject to a background check. That's insanity. And then even the background check system we have has been starved off by Republicans in the Congress of the United States. They won't give enough money to have a system that works routinely in the appropriate time. The gun that was purchased in Charleston at that terrible church shooting was basically sold to that young man because the background check couldn't be completed within 3 days, so he automatically got it. Hey, listen, if I'm a terrorist and I can go in and try to buy a gun and just hope that they don't get the paperwork done in 3 days and I get my gun and I can go to some nightclub in any town or city and kill people.
Well, let's talk about that, because one of the recent proposals on national gun control is the so-called no-fly, no-buy proposal, which would be aimed at people who are suspected terrorists on the no-fly list. It's kind of stunning to a lot of Americans that anyone who's on the no-fly list is not automatically forbidden from buying a weapon, but at this point they're not. Gun advocates like the NRA say that such a law would be a slippery slope chipping away at Second Amendment rights. What's your response to them?
Wait a minute. Terrorists do not have a Second Amendment right to own a gun. The NRA will say anything and do anything, including telling lies, to win their argument. We've got to decide that we're in charge, not the NRA. We've got to decide that we elect congressmen and senators, or state representatives and state senators, who are going to execute the policies that the people of our country overwhelmingly want. They want universal background checks.
When speakers at the Republican convention last week implied that Hillary Clinton would take away Second Amendment rights, and Donald Trump came out really strong telling gun owners, I'm the only one who's going to protect you, how do you reassure independents or people in the middle, people who might have some appeal to the Democratic Party, but at the same time, they believe in their gun rights? How does Hillary Clinton walk that fine line to sort of assure everyone?
I mean, you does, because if somebody thinks that someone's actually out to take their gun away, they're probably lost to the same argument about making sure that things are subject to universal background check. If you buy that NRA argument, you've already turned yourself over to the NRA. The reality is no one's having their guns taken away. What we're talking about is making sure that we have a universal background system so that we're not selling guns to people with mental illness. We're not selling guns to people the day they get out of prison from a felony conviction. We're not selling guns to people who might be terrorists. I mean, this is common sense stuff. We've done it in Connecticut. We haven't taken anyone's gun away that had a right to have that gun. And I'm all for the ability to appeal any decision that's made.
This is such a personal issue for you because you were governor in 2012 and you had to talk to the families. I mean, I can't even imagine having to talk to the parents of 20 young children who were gunned down, plus the 6 adults. I imagine that every time there's another gun massacre in America, like what happened in Orlando recently, you're probably on the phone talking to the governors. What, you know, since this is something that has touched you so personally, what is your plan for how we can prevent more and more of these Sandy Hook and Orlando killings from taking place?
We should elect Hillary Clinton as president of the United States, somebody who's got the guts to take on the NRA and simply get our country to the point where we have common sense rules and regulations about gun ownership. That's number one. Number two, it was a searing experience having to explain to those families that they would not be reunited with their loved one that day. It does change you a little bit, and I suppose that sometimes I come at this pretty hard, but I don't want to see other families have to go through what that family did. Recently, I was down in Orlando, and I made a stop at the Pulse nightclub just to visit and express my condolences on a broader basis to the gay and Latino community in Orlando that clearly was set upon by this individual. We should make America safe. That's what we should do.
Governor, let me ask you something personal, because in some ways, the struggles that you've faced in Connecticut are a microcosm of the challenges that the Democratic Party is facing nationwide. You were, of course, praised by your Democratic base at first for raising taxes on the rich, raising the minimum wage, paid sick leave, criminal justice reform. But in this year's budget, you rejected a third tax increase because high taxes were chasing away business and pushed for cuts in spending and public sector jobs instead. So you were once the darling of labor and progressives. Now you're facing some of the lowest approval ratings of any governor in America. I want to ask you, from your own experience, how can Hillary Clinton promote the progressive agenda that many Democrats want without finding herself in the same position?
Well, first of all, she's not in the same position. She's not running for governor. She's running for president of the United States. Governors have to make hard decisions. Recently in Massachusetts, you've discovered that you have a rather large deficit. We figured that out earlier in Connecticut and responded earlier to it in Connecticut. We watched what was going on in estimates and finals as far as how people were paying their taxes, and we realized that we had to tighten our belt.
But pardon me for interrupting, but presidents do, of course, have to deal with business taxes as well. And American businesses have complained that if corporate taxes get too high, they will continue to move jobs and factories overseas. So she very much does face the same kinds of challenges that you've faced. If she tries to raise taxes, if she tries to put in a lot of the progressive agenda that her base and Bernie Sanders' base have both called for, she's going to face a lot of backlash from Republicans and from corporate America.
Well, I think Democrats think that we should have a tax reform, and I think a lot of Democrats think that we should take a very serious look at the corporate tax rate in America. But a lot of Democrats also believe that we should stop incentivizing companies to move jobs overseas. We shouldn't reward them for that. And that's the language that's in our platform.
Last question. Let me ask you, what do you hope that a Clinton victory, if it happens, would bring for New England?
Well, I think a renewed interest in infrastructure, which would benefit New England. We have some of the oldest transportation infrastructure, particularly on the rail lines. And I know that she is keenly interested in infrastructure investment and moving the national economy forward by investing in infrastructure, just the jobs that are created, but understands that fundamentally we need to modernize our highways, our mass transit systems, our water systems, our sewer systems, and we need to invest in those. She's going to fight for it.
All right. Governor Dan Malloy of Connecticut, also chairman of the Democratic Governors Association, thanks so much for joining us in Radio Boston.
Happy to do it.
After hearing from Governor Malloy and other speakers last night, the Democratic National Convention will hear tonight from the mothers of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Jordan Davis, and other young African-American men and women killed by gun violence. Collectively, they call themselves Mothers of the Movement, and they are throwing their support behind Hillary Clinton. For many activists working to reduce gun violence, though, working with politicians is only part of the equation. Nancy Robinson is executive director of Ladies Involved in Putting a Stop to Inner City Killing, or Lipstick, as they call themselves, an organization based out of Jamaica Plain. She says women can take action right now to stop gun violence, and she joins us now from Philadelphia. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on this show. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And first off, tell us about your group. Why the focus on women, since most gun violence is committed by men?
Right. So the acronym is LIPSTICK, and we are focused on women. You know, men in many of these urban shootings might be the ones pulling the trigger. But the shocking fact is that women are providing many of the guns they're using.
All right. Well, you have talked about how part of the mission of LIPSTICK is trying to wipe out these so-called straw purchases by women. So tell us a little bit more about how women are used as straw purchasers.
Right. So just as vulnerable women are easy prey for drug traffickers or people trafficking, sex traffickers, they're easy prey for gun traffickers who make it their business to provide guns to people who can't get them legally. And the most common way that guns are trafficked into urban neighborhoods is through what you said, a straw purchase. And that's where someone is recruited to buy guns on behalf of somebody who cannot pass a criminal background check. And we're finding that more and more women are playing this role as straw purchaser. They're also hiding and holding the guns that is further enabling these cycles of violence that are playing out on our streets.
So these are women who do not themselves have criminal records, so they come up as clean when they go to a legal gun dealer. Tell
right.
me, how widespread is this practice of using women as straw purchasers?
You know, it's a great question. There's a dearth of research. We're finding out anecdotally and by doing this work every day on the ground in communities that are deeply impacted by gun violence that it's really prevalent. It's common. We do workshops and we have women come and sign pledges vowing not to play this role. And it's catching on like wildfire. As a matter of fact, it's actually working because it's reaching so many women and resonating with them. In Boston, where we are headquartered and where we were originated, we've reduced gun crimes by women by 33%.
By which you mean women involved in the purchase of guns?
Purchase, possession, also. What we're doing is coming in and having these conversations with women for the first time, and it's like this light bulb that goes off where we explain to them that you're jeopardizing your public housing, your freedom, because this is criminal and you could go to jail by supplying guns to the wrong people. You could, you're perpetuating the violence. You're providing guns to people who are likely to use them to kill and injure your neighbors, your family members. We know a woman who was trafficking guns and the gun was later used to shoot her. Mm. And she realized that it was one of the guns that she had put on the street. So this is a big problem. 25% of Chicago's crime guns come from women, just to give you an example of the magnitude of this. And the good news about LIPSTICK is we're breaking those cycles of violence and exploitation. We're breaking those cycles that put the gun in the wrong hands.
Well, I saw a figure from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms that half of all gun trafficking investigations involve a straw purchaser. And from
right.
what you're saying, many of those are women. But let me ask you, how do you convince women to stop buying guns for men, especially when the women involved may need the money that's being offered to incentivize them?
You're absolutely right. There's a range of motivations. Women are motivated because they think they're in love, so they're very loyal to the man. There's a ride or die ethic that's pervasive. in many of these communities. And they're also motivated by money. They're living in poverty. I know a woman who bought guns illegally in exchange for diapers. Sometimes there are substance abuse issues. But almost always, the women are in the dark about the consequences. We help them connect the dots. We help them understand that these are the guns that are used, turned against them, and used to kill and maim in their own communities.
Themselves,
so it's
or
that
their
awareness.
Children.
Themselves, their children. It has devastating consequences. And we come along and we're the first to really have this conversation. And, you know, I thought it would be tougher to convert women and to have this catch on, but it's not. It's easy because these women you're going to hear from tonight and the women we're working with, they are out front on this issue. And they always have been. They are always, they're working every day, day and night, finding solutions, enacting solutions, because, you know, these are their children. These are all of our children. But gun violence is the number one killer of African-American young men as young as age 12. Mm. So this is a dire problem, and we're just thrilled that your program today and the program tonight is finally having this conversation about how we need to make this a higher priority in our country, and we really need to back solutions like lipstick that are doing something about it.
We'll certainly be hearing more about it tonight. Last week, Massachusetts State Attorney General Maura Healey announced that gun manufacturers and dealers would no longer be allowed to sell what she called copycat assault weapons. Of course, those are the slightly modified versions designed to fall outside of the purview of Massachusetts' assault weapons ban. Here's some of what she said.
So this directive will not apply to guns bought or sold prior to today. Gun dealers who currently have these weapons on hand are not permitted, however, to sell them to Massachusetts buyers. They may transfer them out of state to jurisdictions where sales of these weapons are still legal.
All right. Well, it sounds a little bit like a shell game, that they can be moved there even if they're not going to be here. So what impact, if any, will this directive have on gun trafficking?
You know, there are a lot of approaches. Lipstick is taking a slightly different approach to try to solve this problem. And again, you know, we're actually effective in reducing gun crimes by women by 33%. I just am so encouraged by that fact. So I keep mentioning it. But so our approach is more akin to Mothers Against Drunk Driving. It's changed our awareness of the risks of drinking and driving, and Lipstick operates in much the same vein. We want women to be armed with information and understand that if you go up to New Hampshire...
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt, but so do you think that the Attorney General's directive is going to make any difference?
There are lots of approaches. There are lots of tools in our toolkit, and we need to be using every resource available. Lipstick just takes a different approach.
So let me ask you about Hillary Clinton's positions on gun violence and gun control and the Democratic Party's official platform. Or are you satisfied with these?
Oh, I'm thrilled that we're having this conversation and on a national scale. And I want to say, I'm at the DNC right now, but we were invited here, and we'd be thrilled to have this conversation. And we would have been at the Republican National Convention, but we weren't invited. So we're a nonpartisan group, and we welcome everybody to have this conversation about what to do about gun violence in general, and specifically about the kinds of shootings that are happening in cities across the country that don't make national headlines. We've got to stop turning a blind eye to what's happening in our urban neighborhoods.
All right. Well, last question. What specific concrete suggestions do you want to hear, not only from tonight's speakers, but from Hillary Clinton when she speaks on Thursday night about how to stamp out gun violence and not interfere with the Second Amendment?
Right. Exactly. You're right. This is not a Second Amendment problem. We can reduce shootings, especially kinds of shootings that are happening in urban centers, and still uphold Second Amendment rights. It's not an either or. And I would ask listeners to go to our website, www.operationlipstick.org. And I want the next president, whoever that is, and everybody listening, to make solving this problem of gun violence a higher priority. And it starts with this platform and this conversation. And I welcome political leaders on both sides of the aisle to have this conversation.
That's Nancy Robinson, Executive Director of Ladies Involved in Putting a Stop to Inner City Killing. Nancy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a privilege.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and we're going back to Philadelphia on day two of the Democratic National Convention in the City of Brotherly Love. And joining us is Anthony Brooks, senior political correspondent. Anthony, welcome.
Good to be here, Indira.
So yesterday, the focus was on party unity amid this noisy revolt by some Bernie Sanders supporters. Then First Lady Michelle Obama stole the show with an emotional speech that brought Democratic delegates to their feet. Let's listen.
This November, when we go to the polls, that is what we're deciding. Not Democrat or Republican, not left or right. No, in this election and every election is about who will have the power to shape our children for the next 4 or 8 years of their lives.
There were speeches from three Bay Staters, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, Congressman Joe Kennedy III, and finally Senator Elizabeth Warren.
If you believe that America must work for all of us, not just for the rich and powerful, then let's work our hearts out to make Hillary Clinton the next president of the United States.
And tonight, former President Bill Clinton will dominate primetime in his new role as Hillary Booster-in-Chief. So, Anthony, you were there last night. Tell us where you are right now.
Well, right now I'm just off the convention floor where delegates are beginning to assemble. A little while ago, Vice President Joe Biden was out there. Alicia Keys has been doing a sound check with her band. So the delegates are drifting in and preparing for another big night ahead, as you said, which will be dominated by former President Bill Clinton.
So yesterday was this roller coaster for Democrats. There was this noisy band of Bernie diehards, apparently mostly from California, jeering during primetime speeches, even drowning out the comedian Sarah Silverman, who felt compelled to tell them, "You're being ridiculous."
That's right.
It felt a bit off from the day's theme, United Together. Did Bernie manage to calm his troops?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, Bernie Sanders did what he had to do last night. I mean, he doubled down on his endorsement of Hillary Clinton for president. He did everything he could to make a case to his supporters that Hillary Clinton is the best choice for president, and tried to convince supporters who don't want to support her, vote for her, that they're risking putting Donald Trump in the White House. But, you know, this is a fractious group of Sanders, or sort of Bernie or bust people. At one point during the day yesterday, he had to admonish his delegates by saying, "Brothers and sisters, please, this is the real world." So last night we saw him making that strong pitch for Clinton, and by the end of the evening, after his speech, after Michelle Obama's speech, there was a sense that Democrats managed to salvage the day with a positive message and offer a glimpse of the kind of unity that Democrats want to present here. But Indira, it has to be said, there's a hardcore faction of Bernie or bust delegates here. As you mentioned, a lot of them are in the California delegation. They're still here. My guess is we're still going to be hearing from them.
What about within the Massachusetts delegation? Are any of those people diehard Bernie or bust folks?
If they are, I haven't spoken to them. The Bernie delegates, the Bernie Sanders delegates that I've spoken to in Massachusetts reluctantly say, "We get it. He's not going to be president, and we're going to vote for Hillary Clinton," even without enthusiasm.
Let's talk about Michelle Obama for a while. She was obviously the show stealer. I mean, she seemed to be the only one who was able to silence disaffected Sanders supporters.
It's true. I mean, that was quite a speech. I mean, the delegates were all on their feet, and she really managed to turn a day that was marked by division and anger into a real sort of vision and hope. You know, a couple of interesting things about Michelle Obama. She really challenged Donald Trump's view of America as a country in crisis, never mentioning his name, but challenging the very idea that this is a country that needs to be made great again. You know, in her view, this is a country that is already great. She made a strong case for her husband's record, a big push for Hillary Clinton, and spoke very movingly. This idea that a black president and a first lady can live in a house built by slaves, suggesting just how far this country has come. It was quite a moment in the convention hall when she spoke last night.
I was also struck by a very emotional Michelle Obama, whose voice even cracked when she talked about how important it was to her that her own daughters learn from Hillary Clinton that being a woman and being president is possible. And that really seemed to move a lot of people. But there was, of course, a very important other woman politician in this case who came right after, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who took a completely different approach and really went after Donald Trump. Let's listen to a bit of that.
Donald Trump said he was excited for the 2008 housing crash that devastated millions of American families because he thought it would help him scoop up more real estate on the cheap. Donald Trump set up a fake university to make money by cheating people and taking their life savings.
Well, she sounded like an attack dog, especially in contrast to Mrs. Obama. How was she received?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I think Elizabeth Warren was in a tough place last night. She followed Michelle Obama. That was a tough act to follow. And, you know, Michelle Obama offered this wonderful oratory and this vision of hope. And Elizabeth Warren came out. And as you said, she sort of had two roles. One was attack dog. She really gave it to Donald Trump. You know, her job was also to kind of provide a sort of bridge to Bernie Sanders and to be almost like a progressive ambassador to Sanders supporters. And I think she did that pretty well. But I think in general, she was more muted maybe than usual. And after Michelle Obama, there was sort of a sense of the air kind of going out of the room a little bit during Elizabeth Warren's speech. Still, I mean, she did what she had to do, you know, and we're going to see her on the campaign trail quite a bit between now and November.
Hmm. Seems like she's a really effective surrogate for Hillary Clinton. All right, Anthony, you've been talking to Massachusetts delegates. You interviewed Congresswoman Catherine Clark of Massachusetts about where things stand in Philadelphia. Let's listen to your interview.
I think that yesterday was our steam valve day, where Democrats who were supporting Bernie Sanders wanted to express how much they care about their candidate. But I think that that was the proper place for yesterday. And as the week progresses, I am sure that we are going to see people coming together supporting Hillary Clinton. The stakes are too high for us with a Trump candidacy not to be unified.
Yeah, so Indira, that's Congresswoman Catherine Clark. And I think that's a hopeful view of sort of mainstream Democrats here who are Hillary Clinton supporters, that, you know, the steam was sort of let out yesterday and now they're in a better position to sort of present a unified party. We'll see if that's the case.
All right, quick last question. Bill Clinton, former president, could be the nation's first gentleman, will be dominating primetime tonight. He is, of course, a famous orator. What are you expecting to hear from him?
Well, it's going to be interesting. I mean, this is the man who knows Hillary Clinton better than anyone. He describes her on the campaign trail as a change maker, someone who knows how to get things done, the right experience, the right background. But Bill Clinton is a complicated figure in this political environment. He supported NAFTA. He supported welfare reform. He supported financial deregulation. Don't ask, don't tell. So it'll be interesting to see how he handles those diehard Sanders or bust faction. I think there's a potential that his speech could inflame the kind of disunity we saw yesterday. On the other hand, Clinton is the consummate politician, and he's nothing if not a master of reading a room. So my guess is he threads the needle pretty effectively and pulls people together. But it's certainly going to be fascinating to watch.
That's Anthony Brooks, WBUR's senior political reporter, speaking with us from the DNC in Philadelphia. Thanks so much, Anthony. Look forward to talking to you tomorrow.
My pleasure, Indira. Always good to talk to you.
In a presidential election year, and especially during the two-party conventions, we're all bombarded by commercials endorsed by political candidates, and we expect, based on our political affiliations, to be inspired or affronted. This week, an unusually political ad for an otherwise apolitical Boston institution, Legal Seafoods, has hit a nerve. The Boston-based restaurant chain ran a full-page ad in the Boston Globe yesterday with a picture of Hillary Clinton. The caption read, "We have a term for cold fish, sushi." It's part of a larger parody campaign that Legal Seafood launched a few months ago, riffing off hot-button political issues like gay rights and marijuana legalization, and touting the restaurant chain's president, Roger Berkowitz, as a presidential candidate. A number of people took to social media yesterday criticizing the ad as sexist and offensive, crossing the line of acceptable humor. We're joined now by Ellis Verdi, president of DeVito Verdi, the New York advertising firm that has long been doing advertisements for Legal Seafoods and has stirred its fair share of controversy with other ads in the past. Thanks for talking with us, Ellis.
Sure.
So, Ellis, first tell us, what was your concept behind these ads where you were using Legal Seafoods CEO Roger Berkowitz as a fake presidential candidate and using the hashtag #FeelTheBerk?
It was in a long history of doing advertising for Roger. It's often not easy to spend money and get attention, and I think that's the intention here. It isn't politics. It's purely commercial.
All right. Well, let me ask you, the term cold fish, referencing a woman lacking in emotion, originated with Shakespeare, like so much of our evocative language in English. And today it's, of course, used to refer to an off-putting or frigid person. Monica Lewinsky claimed she had letters from Bill Clinton in which he called his wife a cold fish and complained about their sex life. So I'm wondering, isn't using that term to refer to a presidential nominee a bit of a low blow?
I think that's probably a lot of extra material that the common person doesn't know. Cold fish is being used for men and for women and a lot of other references all the time. You've given it a lot more context in some respects, at least from your point of view or a point of view, and I'm not sure that was ever intended or part of the conversation when we wrote the...
But you wouldn't have called Hillary Clinton a cold fish in the ad if that weren't out there in the popular imagination. It's certainly not my perception of her as a cold fish. It's the perception that's out there that you are referring to. Whether or not people know about the Monica Lewinsky letters, it certainly is a reference to a frigid woman. So you must have known you were making that reference when you made the ad.
True. You know, it's funny because I've met her many times, and she's quite warm and very friendly. And in fact, I've had a very good experience with her. I don't think there's any political bent or any kind of personal front here. It's really just advertising and commercial use.
Well, as you say, the ad is meant to raise attention for your client, Legal Seafoods. And you, of course, were using this trope of Hillary Clinton as a cold fish as a way to get laughs and raise attention. I'm sure you've seen that social media blew up yesterday with angry reaction among women as well as men who found the ad sexist, and some who even vowed online on Facebook and Twitter not to ever return to the restaurant unless CEO Roger Berkowitz apologizes. Were you surprised by the reaction, and was the CEO?
I think Roger could speak for himself on the surprise. I think he should, know, of course, that we have good 12 years of getting a lot of reactions, some pretty unbelievable, and it comes with, even in this campaign, other ads that got a lot of reaction, perhaps not as many totally as these, but certainly the one that we said, I can assure you it's not the size of your hands that's important, but rather the size of your shrimp.
Well, you're referring to that. Let's play it. Last week, your ad featured Donald Trump. Let's listen.
Some candidates argue about the size of their hands, not Roger Berkowitz.
I can assure you it's not the size of your hands that's important, but rather the size of your shrimp.
Okay, a little bit of a hearty har line, but Donald Trump himself referred to the size of his hands and other parts of his body, but Hillary Clinton never called herself a cold fish. So is it a fair comparison that you're an equal opportunity offender?
It's a good point. I think probably, some people might think the cold fish went further than that one, but in some other people who we've gotten letters from, I've gotten a number of notes that actually this was considered to be far more egregious. And there's another one, the way I see it, these other candidates are kind of like my fish. They don't have a leg to stand on. We showed Hillary in that one as well. I mean,
but you also showed Trump, and that one seemed to be not referring to anyone in a personal ad hominem way, but just sort of saying they don't have a leg to stand on and comparing them to fish, right?
We had positive and negative, and we've had other ones that got tremendous amount. It goes back many years. I think if you look in the history of legal seafoods, you'll see many, many, many times when we've gotten many, many, many responses.
Well, I remember, of course, that you had an ad back in 2008 where you compared the face of a halibut to MBTA conductors, and they got upset about that, and eventually the ads were removed. In 2011, you had a series of ads that sort of made fun of the wildlife and conservation community. Let's listen.
Save the trout. Save it to swim another day through golden brooks and sunlit streams. Or just save it so we can grill that baby up real nice.
Okay, now I think that that ad, while it did offend some conservationists, was one of those things that kind of elicited a laugh from more people than it offended based on the reaction at the time.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, if you tallied up some of those responses, I think you'd see a very large number. The one thing that's different about this particular campaign as a whole, which might be some of what you're reacting to, is that it's timed the way it was. So it's timed during a key period, of course.
I'm not taking a position on this. I'm responding to the outcry that came on social media yesterday. But I will say that I think that anything that calls a woman whose husband has been associated with sex scandals a cold fish, probably no matter what the timing is, would have been accused by some people as being sexist. Let me ask you, do you think people who are reacting are too focused on political correctness, or have you sort of thought about this in the aftermath of the last 24 hours and thought, well, maybe we went a little too far and we're sexist on this one, two guys running an ad agency, maybe without a woman there to think about whether this might be offensive?
We have women here who write some pretty strong pieces of advertising, actually, over the years, some that have been involved in some of this stuff. So it's not that kind of thing. And I don't
Was any woman involved in this ad about Hillary?
I'm not sure. But I do think that there is probably a line that we might have hit, if you will, and that sort of touched off a lot. But I don't know if you have to, how much you have to read into it to get very serious about this. I agree that there is some controversy. I agree that there is some attention that we're getting, and I agree with the fact that the intention of this campaign is really to do that. So it's not a political statement. I mean, as I would tell you now that I'm vociferously in favor of Hillary Clinton. I'm voting for her. I've done work with her. I'm on her side. I'm not sure how this ad has anything to do with that.
I was actually just going to ask you, Hillary Clinton was one of your clients during her 2000 bid for U.S. Senate. She faced criticism that she was a carpetbagger moving to New York to run for Senate. And you did an ad for her. Let's listen.
Not just the First Lady. For 30 years, Hillary Clinton has been fighting for children and families. Hillary for U.S. Senate. Your concerns are her concerns.
So let me ask you, did you have any reservations or second thoughts about creating an ad mocking both a former client and a woman who you just told me you're planning to vote for and who you support?
I'm doing this for purposes of commerce, not politics. So I have to differentiate those thoughts. I'm very clear that this is commerce, not politics. There is a difference.
To that end, some business people, including Donald Trump himself, have said that there is no such thing as bad publicity and that any attention is always good. I want to know, do you think that this is good for legal seafoods, or do you have a few concerns that might hurt your client?
I think that in the end, all of this is very good for Roger and for the business. As long as the majority of people, which I believe exists, they understand that this is really, he's not really running for president. This is not really, this is kind of tongue-in-cheek. It's an association being made. It's kind of fun. And I think the majority of people do feel that way.
That's Ellis Verdi, president of DeVito Verdi, the New York advertising firm that's running the campaign for legal seafoods. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. If you tuned in early to the DNC speeches last night, you may have heard this from Pennsylvania Representative Brendan Boyle.
We were raised to believe that in this country, if you work hard, where you come from doesn't determine where you're going. Thanks to many sacrifices, a lot of student loans, and a little luck, I became the first in my family to go to college. As Democrats, our mission is to make more stories like mine more common, not less so.
Boyle mentions hard work, sacrifices, and luck. That last elusive ingredient may be the most overlooked and also the most important, according to Robert Frank, a professor of management and economics at Cornell University. His new book, Success and Luck, Good Fortune, and the Myth of Meritocracy, examines why we underestimate the importance of luck and how that's driving inequality and politics today. He joins us now from Ithaca, New York. Welcome, Professor Frank.
Indira, nice to be with you.
Well, nice to have you. And first, I want to ask, is it unusual in America for a politician to acknowledge the role of luck in his or her success? I mean, I've heard UK Prime Minister David Cameron acknowledge how lucky he was to be born rich and go to great schools. But it seems like American politicians favor the I pulled myself up by my bootstraps narrative.
Yes, I think it is unusual. And oddly, I think people seem to feel apprehensive that if they concede that they had a lucky break or two along the way, people will think less of them somehow. In fact, all available evidence suggests the contrary. We like people who are willing to admit that in addition to being talented and hardworking, which almost all successful people really are, there are lots of talented and hardworking people who don't make it through to the top. And the ones who do typically also enjoyed a bit of luck.
So quickly, give us the top line from your book. Why is luck so important?
It's gotten even more important than it always has been. And that's partly because the highest incomes that are awarded these days are in what we call winner-take-all markets. Technology has enabled people to extend their reach over broader and broader areas. That means we don't need tens of thousands of local accountants anymore to help people with their taxes. It's enough that we have one user-friendly tax software package. In the early days, there were hundreds of those displacing accountants, but at some point, the reviewers decided that TurboTax was the best one. And from then on, it was them dominating the market. So we've got the owners of that business walking away with very, very big payoffs. The rest of the pack, often just a hair's breadth behind them in terms of quality and effort, get almost nothing. So if you're competing for one of those top prizes, what we know is that there are thousands and thousands of contestants. And the finalists in those contests, they're all good. Let's find the best one, the hardest working one, who's got the most talent. That person is going to have average luck. Hmm. So because, you know, we chose him because he was the best, not because he was either lucky or unlucky. There are going to be hundreds of people almost as good as that person. Most of them won't have good luck either, but some small number of them will. And so
all of this goes back even to a more basic question of where you're born. I mean, you talk about the importance of being born in a first world country.
Yes, Mr. Boyle enjoyed some luck here, but his big break came when he was born in the United States instead of in South Sudan. Yeah, there's no way that talent and hard work can make much of your life if you're born in the wrong environment.
Well, you say that the question, how we answer the question ourselves of how important luck is in each of our own life stories reliably divides people into conservatives or liberals, Republicans or Democrats. How so?
Well, there's a tendency there. So I think it's true that conservatives are more likely to stress individual initiative and hard work in their explanations of success. There's no problem at all with that explanation. Certainly, those are qualities that are right at the forefront of explaining success in most cases. I think liberals are more inclined to look at life circumstances when they explain success stories. The differences in emphasis don't describe a very sharp divide between the two groups. And really, there's a lot of truth in both elements. If you want to succeed, first thing out of the gate to be important, work hard and have talent. If you want to see who succeeds in the set of people who have those qualities, you'll want to look who got the lucky break at the right time.
Well, in your book, you mention Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren's 2012 campaign speech in which she said there's nobody in this country who got rich on his own. Here she is last night telling her story.
I'm a janitor's daughter who became a public school teacher, a professor, and a United States senator. America is truly a country of opportunity. I am deeply grateful to that America. I believe in that America, but I'm worried. I'm worried that my story is locked in the past, worried that opportunity is slipping away for people who work hard and play by the rules.
All right, so is there a difference between what she calls luck and what she calls opportunity?
You know, I don't really make a fine distinction between any of the different kinds of external forces that matter in life outcomes. If you get hit by a car, that's bad luck. If you are born with a lot of good talent and drive, that's good luck. But so is being born in a place where if you have those qualities, you can put them to work for yourself. So really what we're talking about in general is just the whole mix of things other than what you do. If you're talented and hardworking, that's good. Where did those qualities come from? Not everybody has them. We know they came from either your upbringing or your genes. Which of those factors do you think it's okay to claim moral credit for?
Well, if we tie it back to politicians who are always touting the American dream, regardless of which party they're from, the idea is that anyone who works hard can get ahead regardless of background. Do you think that's actually a myth?
I think there are many people who work hard and who are talented who don't get ahead much. The idea that those are sufficient conditions for success has never been true. It's less true now than it was in the past. If you don't work hard, you're almost certainly not going to succeed. So don't take the message to be that hard work doesn't matter. It truly does matter.
Well, what about the policy implications of all of these discoveries and analysis you've done? You're a behavioral economist, it seems. So if people are downplaying luck in their own stories of their success, and especially if politicians downplay the role of luck, what does that mean for public policy? What do you think we should be doing in a public policy forum to even the playing field and allow as many people as possible in this country to be lucky and put their hard work and their talents to good use?
You know, you have to have the opportunity to do those things. And if you're in the wrong environment, you can't. So when I graduated from college, my family didn't have much money, but I graduated debt-free. Today, someone like me would graduate with $40,000 or $50,000 worth of debt. There's a movement now to try and redress that problem. I think it would be good to press on. It's going to cost money to do that. Most people think it's a bad thing that the smart kids from poor families are less likely to graduate from college now than the dumb kids from rich families. That's not a good thing. But to do something about that will cost some money. I think the good news is that it wouldn't be as painful as most people think it would. Look, if you're a prosperous person, what do you want? You want something special. That's defined almost completely in relative terms. So if you're prosperous and you paid a little bit less and had a little bit less to spend on things you want, that means your mansion would be a little smaller. You'd spend a little less on your car. The diamonds you give as gifts would be a little smaller.
Wouldn't we all like to get diamonds as gifts or be able to give them?
We're talking about prosperous people now, and the celebrations of special occasions, they'd cost less money. But since all
if there
those
were
things
a consumption
relative,
tax that were progressive, is what you're saying. If there were higher taxes on wealthier
never mind
people.
Where we got the tax. If people had less money to spend on those things, the standards would adjust accordingly, and all the prosperous people would be just as happy as before. You know, weddings cost $30,000 on average now. 30 years ago, they cost $10,000. Nobody's any happier today because of that extra expenditure.
All right. Robert Frank is a professor of management and economics at Cornell University. His new book is called Success and Luck, Good Fortune and the Myth of Meritocracy. You can find out much more about his book on our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR Boston's NPR news station. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. Join us again tomorrow for much more Radio Boston.